dog, but before the plates were clean, there he was, forearms raw with scratches from the workshop lathe. He made a muted hello, took his place at his father's right hand, and set about devouring what was left. "This thing isn't going away," Papa Jack began. Ordinarily, newspapers were good for only one thing in the Emporium. Every gazette that came through the door was shredded up for papier-mâché, or used to line the workshop floors. But he had a collection at his feet, and brushing aside one of the patchwork cats who had escaped from its packing, he lifted up the first. Liège had been broken. Alsace and Lorraine were overrun, but so too were islands in the South Pacific rearing up. French and British soldiers had marched into Togo and taken it from its German governors, and into the fray marched legions from that vastness Jacob's Godman had once called home. The Russians were in East Prussia and marching west. I think we have to accept that. 200,000 English boys already in France. That changes everything. Kathy? Kathy had wanted to usher Martha out of the room, but the girl would only listen with an ear at the wall. Standing up, she held forth a leaf of paper. The letter had arrived with the day's second post. She had known it was Lizzie by the florid script on the front. Her father sometimes sent cards, but his was a simple, workmanlike hand. But she had not known what its contents would be. She's going too. They're taking nurses out of Homerton and sending them out, with the British Red Cross. My little sister, going to war. It seemed scarcely credible, even as Kathy gave it voice. Lizzie Ray, destined to marry rich and live a spoilt life, was off to save lives while the world frayed apart all around her. Something had changed in Lizzie the year Kathy ran away. Kathy had thought she might come to the Emporium, spend seasons with her and Martha in the Isles, but instead Lizzie had landed in Homerton to train as a nurse. Kathy had often wondered, was she looking for her own Emporium? Well, now she had found it, in the makeshift barracks and tents of some French field. Kathy trembled as she read out the letter. It was so inordinately foolish, so incredibly brave. Lizzie Ray, who wouldn't get dirt beneath her nails without causing a fuss. "Well," said Mrs. Horning, because somebody had to fill the silence, "we must all do our part." By the head of the table, Emile sat bolt upright, spraying suet pudding. "Just what do you mean by that?" All eyes turned on him. His face was purpling with rage. When nobody answered him, he was on his feet. When they kept staring, his fists were up. Beneath the table, Sirius yapped. "I'm the one who tried, aren't I? I'm the one who went out and tried to do my part, while you all sat here just talking about it. And now you dare to stare at me like this, like I'm some coward. Is that it? Well, I'm sick and tired of being the odd one out in this Emporium. I'm sick and tired of being overlooked. I tried and..." His anger had carried him so far, but now his words were failing him. Another tortuous silence threatened, until Kathy, who had never liked seeing Emile squirm, ventured, "Oh, Emile, you tried to sign up." So that was why he had come storming back into the Emporium this morning, unable to look her in the eye. "I did," Emile breathed, and now that his valiant feat was acknowledged, he sank back into his seat. "But what would you know? They wouldn't have me. Asthma, they told me. A weak heart. They said I should find a physician. Well, I've more heart than any of you. I tried, didn't I?" Sadly, he spooned in the last of his pudding. "This morning, pig's blood sprayed all up the shop front. You might have thought they'd brought that pig kicking and squealing and cut its throat there and then." Rage was infectious. Now Mrs. Horning seemed to be purpling herself. Kathy touched her forearm as if to soak up some of the anger, but instead she started to feel it too. "It's a shame you didn't make it, young Emile. Somebody ought to give those bastards, there, I said it, filled with their fear and hate, something to think about. Show them all foreign-born art to be reviled. Why, they'll come here and play with your toys one winter, then come to vandalize the next. Well, we ought to be showing them we'll stand up to be counted. And not because we're English, because we've no need to be. Because we're people. Emil had finished his suet pudding but continued to scratch at the bowl. Meal times are not for fighting, Papa Jack began. There is enough warring outside these walls to make war among ourselves. Emil, you are my son and I love you. Today you surrendered a part of yourself. That they sent you back here does not diminish the trying. He paused, clasping Emil with one of his mammoth hands. But you are right, dear Mrs. Horning. I have longed to make the Emporium apart from the world, but we are, and will always be, a part of the world. This morning proves we are not forgotten, and they will come again. We need to do our part, said Mrs. Horning, repeating it like a petition. We must, said Papa Jack. There was silence. For a time, nobody could look at Emil. They kept their faces buried in their bowls. Then, when it was not enough to ignore his anguish any longer, their eyes seemed repelled, moving as one along the length of the table, past Papa Jack, past Kathy, past Mrs. Horning, to its other end. There sat Caspar, engaged in a suppertime skirmish with Martha. His salt cellar was advancing on her fortress of interlocked knives and spoons. Until now he had pointedly been ignoring his brother's disgrace, for a look from Caspar could have turned Emil's rage incandescent. Now he looked up, to see his family staring back at him. His face opened wide in dumb realization. Kathy curled up, Caspar around her. Small as she was, she fit perfectly inside the arc of his body. How are we going to tell her? We'll tell her her father is a brave, brave man. She'll miss you. Kathy paused. I'll miss you. Don't think I haven't thought the same. I've spent almost every day with you since I shuttered you up in my Wendy house, Kathy. It isn't the Emporium that's my universe. It's you. Of course, they may not take me yet. They may find a weak heart. Oh, Kathy sighed. Please. Then more seriously now. You don't have to do this. But I do, thought Caspar. And as soon as he thought it, the idea solidified around him. Kesey and Dunmore, Douglas Flood and John Hallward. They were already part of a battalion. The artisan's rifles. And they were in training, or they were over the water, out in the world. Those last words, out in the world, transformed the way he was thinking. Do you know, he whispered into Kathy's ear, touching it with his lips. I always wanted an adventure. It used to be that sneaking out of the Emporium in summer was enough. But I think back on that journey we made with our papa, over the oceans with a man we barely knew, and for all the wonders in the Emporium Isles, was anything as adventurous as this? I'll be gone mere months. I wouldn't even miss first frost. I could be out there with those Emporium boys and back by opening night. Perhaps this is the adventure for now. Kathy turned in his arms, to face his naked chest. You'll write. I'll write, the most florid, extravagant letters a wife ever received. She held his hand, searched for the simple wedding band there. I keep it on you always, no matter where you are or whatever you do. Until I die, he whispered. Sirius was at the foot of the bed. He let out a disenchanted moan. Daybreak found Emil in his workshop. If he had cared to look in the mirror this morning, he did not, for fear of the man who would be glowering back, he would have seen his eyes bloodshot and red. If Papa Jack, Kathy, or any of the rest had pressed him on it, he would have told them it was exhaustion, and the evidence of that would have been piled up around him. For last night toy soldiers had sprung out of his lathe like a plague. And the red on his fingertips was the residue of the paint he had used to dress them in their finery, But he would have been lying. For last night, Emile had ventured into the Emporium attics, those great antechambers where whole childhoods are stored away, and unearthed the first games he and Caspar used to play. Crude toy soldiers and their three-legged mules, maps they had painted across which they fought the first battles of the Long War, a spinning top that Caspar had given to Emile that first Christmas they were English boys, its edges grooved so perfectly it hummed a lullaby as it spun. It was spinning now, up on the shelf above his worktop, spinning beside the Imperial Capitan. It had been spinning all night, and, though there was no magic in it, not like the toys Caspar now made, still Emile kept seeing memories manifesting themselves in the edges of his vision. He and Caspar gambling through the empty Emporium the first morning their papa took the lease on the place, he and Caspar kindling a fire together, that night they got lost in the shifting aisles and couldn't find their way back. The spinning top stopped, skittering up against the Imperial Capitan. Emile was about to set it spinning again when he realized he was no longer alone. In his workshop door, Mrs. Hornung was waiting. "Emile, it's time. I'll be out presently. Young man, your brother is leaving now." Emile ground his teeth. Why was it Mrs. Hornung always made him feel like this? He was a little boy again, clinging on to her apron tail. He remembered, starkly, the time he had mistakenly called her mother, and the look of consternation that had flickered across her face. That night, Papa Jack had come to smooth his bedsheets around him, while Mrs. Hornung took a day's leave. Some boys, all they wanted was a mama. "I can't." "You must." He spun around. "But I mustn't, don't you see? He's going off, and it should have been me. I should be the one. If it weren't for my heart, I would be. And now it will be..." He stopped. Seemingly he had changed what he was going to say, because when he spoke again it was with a new, forced lightness. "Caspar has a daughter." "She should have been mine too," was the terrible thought that entered his mind. "He has a wife? And Kathy? Kathy should have been... He shouldn't have to leave them, and all on my account." "This isn't on your account, Emile. There are thousands of men like Caspar crossing over the water." She touched him like a mother might touch him, and that only made Emile hate himself more. "You'll regret it if you don't." Caspar was in the Half Moon Hall when Mrs. Hornung and Emile made their way up the aisle. He was crouching down, his arms wrapped around Martha, and when he stood up, the girl would not let go. She was dangling from his neck. It took Kathy to prise her away, and then she herself needed prising. Papa Jack clasped Caspar by the hand, drawing him into a mountainous embrace. And Emile lingered on the edges of it all. "Back by first frost," Caspar declared. He took each of them in until, finally, his eyes landed on his brother. "You'll look after them for me, of course." Emile tumbled forwards, betrayed by his own feet. He wrapped himself in his brother's arms, fumbling a fist into the pocket of his greatcoat. Then he unfurled his fingers. There were words being whispered into Emile's ear. "Look after our Emporium well, little brother. And I love you, Emile." Emile did not say it in return, but as Caspar reached the end of Iron Duke Mews, he knew it all the same. A little spinning top had been tucked into his pocket, and as he walked, it was humming a tune he had never forgotten. The Emporium was empty that day, more empty than the most barren of summer days. Kathy busied herself fixing the braids of Papa Jack's ragdolls. Martha's tutor, Mr. Attlee, whose own sons had already gone where Caspar had followed, arrived to teach her the simple precepts of trigonometry, and to bore her senseless to boot. Mrs. Hornung lost herself in a maelstrom of cookery, filling the kitchens with a sense of Caspar's favourite foods, of kasha and dumplings, as if that might keep a little part of him here, where he belonged. And Emile waited nervously outside his papa's workshop door, watching through the crack as his father stitched more flaming feathers into his phoenix's hide. "Papa," he said, finally pushing through. How many times had he come to this workshop as a boy, sat cross-legged on the floor and watched as his father brought some new fantasia to life? "Papa, are you well?" It was not often that this man, as old as mountains, looked bereft, but he looked bereft now. "Don't be sad, Papa. There are times when it is good and right to feel sad," Papa Jack whispered. It was only now that Emil noticed that the wind-up mechanism from the trunk beneath the shelves, the one with the little figurines and a barren snowscape, had been set on the mantel. Papa Jack had been playing with it then, visiting that place in the tundra where he had first learned the magic in toys. In that moment, Emil understood the weight of his father's sadness. For wasn't Casper going where Papa Jack had gone before? Marched off into the world with a pack on his shoulder and no certainty he was ever coming home. A new, terrible feeling rose into Emil's gorge. "I want it to be me," he thought. "I want it to be me so that I can be close to my papa." "Casper will be home soon. We can hope, at least." For a time there was silence. Emil found a felt sack filled with tiny leather balls and sank into it. A chair sprang up around him, moulding to the shape of his body. "It's going to be strange without my brother, but we can do it, can't we, Papa? The Emporium is still going to open. There's still going to be first frost, and the people will still come, Casper or not. I and Duke Muse will be filled with them, and they'll be expecting miracles. They'll want them this year more than any. Opening night can still be a spectacle. I know I have my..." He had to rush the word because he barely wanted to say it at all. "Limitations, Papa, but I can do it. I promise I can." Papa Jack threw himself to his feet, the phoenix tumbling to the floor, where it picked itself up and looked disdainfully on. In two great strides he had crossed the workshop and smothered Emil in his arms. It had been an eon since Emil felt his father up close, smelt the powder gathered in his beard, the heady scent of wood chippings, axle grease and glue. "I don't want to hear you say those things again, Emil. You're my son, just as Casper is. Your toys belong in these aisles just as much as mine, just as much as your brother's. We have a ship to sail, boy. Let's do it together." Out on the balcony, Emil stared into the shell of the half-finished cloud castle and listened to his father's words reverberating in his skull. One of his papa's patchwork Pegasi had wound down by the castle portcullis. Casper had planted instant trees along the moat, so that the unfinished walls were hidden in tumbling foliage and paper vines. Emil could build neither of those things. He could not replace the magic that had marched off to war with his brother. And yet, a new idea was forming. Not an idea for a toy, nor an idea about opening night, but an idea about himself. His father's words had opened up something inside him. There were, he decided with something approaching confidence, a dozen different ways to be spectacular. Magic might have been one of them, but there were others. And if Casper was not here this year, if opening night was not to be his, well, perhaps there was something he, Emil, could do. Perhaps this was his moment to stand up, to be noticed, to get the recognition he and his toy soldiers had always deserved. As he stood on the balcony, he imagined the aisles below thronged with customers. He imagined boys pouring into the dells he had made between the stands, where epic battles were being fought, the air alive with cries of exhilaration and delight. His winter, he thought. His Emporium. This would be the winter of the Long War. With that in mind, he made haste for his workshop. There was much work to do, and mere months to go. Caspar wrote every day as he promised he would. Days passed without letters, then arrived in a flurry. 4, 5, 6 of them landing on the mat, or ferried up to the quarters between Sirius's soft felt jaws. Each night Kathy sat at the end of Martha's bed, Sirius lounging between them, asking either for his tummy to be tickled or for his gears to be wound tighter, that he might beat his tail with even more loyalty for his missing master, and read them aloud. After that, she retired to the empty bed and savoured each sentence alone. At night the skies are open, and Douglas Flood makes merry with his violin. In our billets we eat snail and French sausage and talk of the Emporium this Christmas. I am well, my Kathy, my Martha. The French air is bracing, and as we march for the sea. I imagine an Emporium in Paris, or one in Liège, one in New York when I forget where I am, one in St. Petersburg, all the grand places of the world. And what we might do together one day. For the world is more vast than you can tell, and I am living in it now. P.S. Here is a design for a constant burrow, that boys and girls might have underworld dens in their gardens. We are digging in ourselves now, and it is exhilarating work. Perhaps Emile might construct one. Sometimes there were notes hidden in the letters. The capitals might spell out, "Remember our Wendy house," or in minute script, illegible except to a magnifying glass, sentences looped inside tiny O's or crammed up inside a question mark. "You would love Paris, Kathy, and I will bring you here when the war is finished. Summer in Paris is divine. Winter would be perfect." Mr. Attlee had Martha compiling a scrapbook, all the places her father had seen, all the foods he had eaten and the people he met. Kathy kept a scrapbook of her own, and in it she counted the days. August became September. October arrived more swiftly than it ought. Paris was saved from what had seemed a certain fate. An armada of taxicabs came together to deliver soldiers to the city's defence. Odessa was ravaged by shells from the sea. The Turks drew lots and entered battle in the east. But inside the Emporium, the world did not change. The aisles were replenished in anticipation of first frost. Toy soldiers and princesses, patchwork dogs and all the toil of Papa Jack's summer. The cloud castle, anchored in the Emporium dome, grew a drawbridge and walls. In the workshops, patchwork reindeer were taught how to walk, then finally how to fly. The movements of autumn heralding the movements of Christmas were the same as in every other year. And yet sometimes Kathy woke in the night to find her bed empty, or worse still, that Martha, haunted by some phantom image of her father, was occupying the place where Caspar once lay. And this was her constant reminder. This year was not like every other. Not at all. Then came the night when Kathy walked through the paper trees, telling Martha the story of how her life had started here, in the little Wendy house beneath the boughs, and looked up to see the glass at the height of the Emporium dome was incandescent with tiny droplets of ice. "Look, Martha." Her daughter's eyes were agog as Kathy lifted her up, the better to see the way the crystals caught and trapped the moonlight above. The first frost of winter. A magical moment, one for which every devotee of the Emporium hungered. And yet this year it was tinged with sadness, for Caspar hadn't made it home after all. Daylight had not yet fallen upon the grand arcades of Regent Street when the shop hands lined up at the Emporium door. Those who had chanced to see the first frost forming had rapidly packed their bags and made their pilgrimage to Iron Duke Mews. Among them were the flatterers, confidence men and tricksters who thought to try their luck and sneak within. But Emile stood diligently by the door, turning away any ne'er-do-wells who gathered in the alley. When he was done, he hurried back across the shop floor, and there he met Kathy, standing in the aisle. He looked white as the frost itself. "It's down to you now, dear Kathy. I can't recall an opening night with so many new hands, not since our very first." There were familiar faces this season, but in the half-moon hall the new shop hands gathered, nervously awaiting their introduction to the aisles. Kathy, who had sifted through the letters of entreaty that piled up on Papa Jack's mat, knew already that most would be girls, but in her mind she had imagined them as images of herself, the runaway coming to the Emporium with little more than the clothes she stood up in. Instead, she found mothers and grandmothers, elder sisters and aunts, the rags of families left behind this Christmas, eager for change. At least Sally Ann was here. That calmed Kathy. "Just us this year, girl. We're to sail this ship, are we?" "We still have a meal," Kathy replied. "Oh," she said, rolling her eyes, "we'll always have a meal." It seemed a spiteful thing to say, but then Sally Ann had not seen the way he grew purple with shame that day he had tried to sign up. In the weeks approaching first frost, Kathy had seen how feverishly he worked. It meant the world to Emil that this season should not suffer, because Casper was not here to sprinkle his magic up and down the aisles. Kathy stepped forward, facing the crowd. "I remember the first day I stood in this hall," she began, and she vividly did. The cold at her back, the emptiness gnawing in her belly, the exhilaration of escape. "Savor it, because, though this could be the first of many Emporium seasons, you will never have a first time again. Tonight the spectacular will happen. Christmas begins, and I know how much you all need Christmas." She paused, thinking of Casper behind the lines in some derelict barracks. "But there is work to do before those doors open, and so few hours to do it. I hope you're ready." At this point, a mechanical reindeer, all of its patchwork sloughing off, came cantering down the aisle, Sirius chasing wildly behind. Kathy closed her eyes. This was going to be more arduous than she thought. "You'll need to show some of them how to wrangle them," she whispered to Sally Ann. "Papa Jack has so much in store. Let's take them on a tour, show them what they're letting themselves in for." Kathy nodded. "But don't go losing one of the grandmothers in the storerooms. We haven't time to organize search parties." Sally Ann grinned. "Not this year." Sally Ann relished playing Mother Hen and led them into the aisles. A diminutive grandmother with tight white curls, a middle-aged couple who clasped each other's hands as they filed past, a young man dragging behind him a lame leg, and somebody's spinster aunt. The Emporium would have a motley crew this Christmas, but motley did not have to mean miserable. Kathy was about to follow the procession when a girl caught her eye. She might have been no more than 15, 16 years old, with hair as red as anger, and somehow this struck Kathy as familiar. Her eyes were grey and marked by freckles, her teeth just crooked enough to be noticed. She had been fixing Kathy with a look, trying to pluck up the courage to talk. Being a mother made you think impossible things. There must have been only 6 or 7 years between them, and yet by instinct Kathy put a comforting arm around her shoulder. "You mustn't be nervous. This winter you'll see such magical things." "You're Kathy Godman, aren't you?"
"I am."
"My name's Francis," she ventured. "Francis Kesey. My brother, Robert." Kathy beamed. "You're Robert's sister?" She nodded, finding her nerve. "He spoke so much about this place. That's why I'm here, you see, to see all the things my brother talked about." She spoke in the same broad Cornish that Robert Kesey had spoken, even more his sister in voice than she was in the flesh. "Oh, we didn't believe it, Mrs. Godman. That first Christmas he came here, we thought he had a girl or was just trying to be contrary, because that was his way. That maybe he'd been gone from home so long just to spite our parents. Robert liked to tell a tale, and when he talked about patchwork dogs and trees bursting out of tiny wooden shells and, why, Wendy House is bigger on the inside, well, we could be forgiven for thinking he was having us on. It wasn't until the next year, when I woke at New Year and there were paper trees all over our garden, a whole forest of them sprouted overnight, that I knew it was real. After that, he'd bring gifts every year. I have a ballerina, a mouse who turns pirouettes up the walls across the ceiling. I have a dress that shows me how to dance." She stopped. Kathy thought, how strange for a girl to be overcome with such emotion. "He was going to bring me here one day. We would ride on runnerless rocking horses together, or we'd sneak into the storerooms and see the patchwork giants Papa Jack makes in secret. Woolly mammoths and cave bears and... are there truly spiders, the size of a horse sleeping in the cellars? So you see, I had to come and see it for myself. I want to feel the things he felt, eat dinners in the palace each night and make merry with the other shop hands and maybe, just maybe, open up my own patchwork dog and be the first thing its black button's eyes see when I wind it up. The girl's words exploded. Now they were formless, ugly things as she tried to contain her tears. "I'm sorry, Mrs. Godwin," she said, straightening herself up. "You must think me frightful, and I have been ever since that telegram arrived. My mother and father, they don't know I'm here, you see. But I had to come to honor Robert, to remember." By now, Sally Ann and the rest had reached the heart of the shop floor. Over the aisles, Kathy could hear her dividing them into parties, assigning roles, assigning tasks. But Francis Kesey's words had given Kathy a chill for which she was not prepared. "You'd better run along before they get ahead of us." Composing herself, Francis Kesey took off up the aisle. "We'll look after you here," Kathy called. Francis Kesey looked back and allowed herself a one half-smile. Perhaps Kathy's words had brought her comfort. Perhaps this winter was everything the girl needed, for all she would have to do was touch one of Papa Jack's toys and be spirited back to the childhood game she and Robert once shared. But her own words had opened up a chasm in Kathy. Robert Kesey dead. Dozens of letters from Casper, and he hadn't said a thing. Martha had hardly slept the night before, dreaming of the magics of opening night. In their quarters, where Mr. Attlee diligently tried to instruct her in the basic structures of Latin, all the secret meanings hidden inside her mother's old edition of Gulliver's Travels, her excitement could barely be contained, manifesting itself, as it often did, in lack of interest, contrary questions, and downright insolence. Mr. Attlee, who would, if you had badgered him, have admitted to a tingle of excitement himself, was ready to accept defeat, and would have done so right then if only he hadn't heard Martha's mother marching past the study door. Bracing herself, Kathy strode into the bedroom. Casper's letters were kept in a bundle in the bedside dresser. She lifted them out and spread them on the eiderdown. "My own Kathy," read the first letter. "My only Kathy," read the second. She read about his basic training and his journey across the water. She read about the barracks in which the artisan's rifle spent their nights, the scent of wild flowers in a Flanders meadow. She read about the card games they played after dark and the wages they made. It was only when she went looking for it that she noticed, a month ago, all remarks about Robert Kesey had evaporated from Casper's letters. He still spoke fondly of Andrew Dunmore, of John Horwood and Douglas Flood, but Robert Kesey was dead and it hadn't merited a mention. A lie of omission was still a lie. She sat for long hours, reading the letters over and over, and only now did she see. These letters were about nothing at all. They were bedtime stories. Things he had contrived from the banal moments of his days, letters designed to protect her and nothing else. To protect her from knowing. To protect her from the truth. She was trembling. This was fury like she had never felt, when there came a tentative tapping at the door. By the time she turned around, Emile was already nosing his way in. Kathy thought, get out now. But Emile was wearing that same anxious look he had on the eve of every opening night, and something in it made the anger bleed out of her. "Kathy, it's time." Her eye shot to the window. The afternoon darkness was hardening to night, her entire afternoon wasted in these letters, while a fresh band of shophands were tasked with preparing the Emporium for its biggest night of the year. She felt the shame of it, hot and urgent. Martha appeared beside Emile, Mr. Attlee hovering behind. "Mama," she grinned. "Come on, we mustn't miss it." Kathy gathered the letters together, not caring when they crumpled in her hands. As she crossed the room, she caught sight of herself in the mirror, still in her day dress with the dust of forgotten aisles up and down her arms. Her hair was a mess. Her fury had deepened the creases in her cheeks. But this would have to do. A gong was sounding on the shop floor. The seconds were counting down. As they reached the shop floor, Kathy's shame turned to relief. What magics they had worked while her head was buried in those letters. Around her, every aisle was garlanded with lights. High above, the Emporium dome was swirling with pinpoints of white, like constantly falling snow. The arches that opened each aisle were wreathed in holly leaves of crepe paper and card. Plump red berries of papier-mâché hung from every leaf. Pipe cleaner owls stood in the boughs of the paper trees. The carousel turned and sang, and the vaults above the aisles were a circus show of dragon longships, patchwork Pegasi, and a white-laced wyvern whose body was wrapped around the turrets of Emile's cloud castle. The shop hands were all flocking in the same direction. The aisles had separated and moved while Kathy had been up above, and now they all led into a single great boulevard charting the length of the Emporium floor. Where there had once been polished floorboards, now there were the cobbles of an open-air market, and it was here that the confetti fountain constantly burst forth, painting the air with images of horses mid-canter, great dragons and knights. She and Martha joined the procession and stopped where the crowd was gathered in the half-moon hall. Here, through frosted glass, she could see Iron Duke Mews thronged with mothers and their excited broods. The bells stopped pealing. All was silent on the Emporium floor. From the forested alcoves to the cloud castle halls, not a creature was stirring, not even a mouse. Then, without being touched, the doors opened. Winter rushed in with its perfect icy breath, and on it came a tide of shoppers. In the half-moon hall, the first customers froze. Before they could fan out, their eyes were drawn upward. Kathy looked the same way. Above them, the Cloud Castle drawbridge was lowering, and out of the vault inside, a red carpet rolled. Instead of dropping from the precipice, it slowly unfurled, charting a crimson pathway over the tops of the aisles, until it landed here, at the feet of the first family. From up above, the sound of sleigh bells could be heard. The swirling lights of the castle interior revolved, and through curtains of rippling white the heads of two cloth creatures emerged. Black button eyes and embroidered noses were followed by antlers of crocheted bone. Soon two patchwork reindeer stood regally at the top of the crimson road. Then, each with a nod to the other, they began to canter down. Behind them they trailed a simple wooden sled, its rear piled high with presents, wrapped with silver paper and bows. No passengers descended with the sled. No driver flicked the rein to drive the reindeer on. They cantered without hoofbeats to the half-moon hall, and there they came to a stop, in front of the first family to have breached the doors. The first reindeer nuzzled the hands of the mother. The second reindeer nuzzled the hands of the children, and in that way they directed the family aboard. Then the sled drew around, parted the gathered shop hands, and took off along the cobbled aisle. Somewhere, gramophones began to play. The carousel burst back into life. The shop hands came together in one last burst of applause. And then it was done. Opening night had begun. Danger, adventure, glory. Have you got what it takes? Step up. Be courageous. Fight the brave fight, beat the unbeatable foe, win the unwinnable war. Emile stood atop one of the monstrous bears, which had been armoured and saddled like some monster plucked out of Nordic myth. The glade between the aisles was one of several waiting to be discovered on the shop floor. In front of him, two dozen expectant faces looked up. More were being drawn from the neighbouring aisles, boys straining on their mother's hands. Beneath him, Emil, the god of the battlefield, lay a medieval village in miniature, a rustic landscape where a hand-crafted windmill turned the waters of a stream, where paper trees the size of a boot made forests against the banks, and the hilltops rose in gradients of felt, cloth, and papier-mâché. The houses were tumble-down creations crouched around a market square, where wind-up pigs and cows troughed in the fountain. Soldiers were descending from all sides, the village the scene of the battle. "Take cover!" Emil cried, and one of the boys shuffled his soldiers into a barn. "Enter the fray!" he exclaimed, waving at another boy about to deposit his soldiers to the battle. "Keep tabs on your sergeants, on your captains and mercenaries. You there," he waved at a nervous boy, who was opening a package his mother had purchased and finding a ragtag set of soldiery within. Those soldiers were peasant farmers just 2 days gone, but they'll need to see battle. Then, Emil whipped out another package, which he gave to the boy. Inside were tiny pantaloons, leather jerkins, privates' tunics and redcoats. "Dress them as you see fit, as they rise up through your ranks. This is the long war, boys, and it is only just beginning." Emil threw his arms out. Battle was being joined all around him. Boys had dragged their mothers to the counters, rushed back with their new toys and set them loose at once. Above him, the great banners of the Long War were held aloft by patchwork robins. The walls of the glade were built from boxes that boys might buy. They said Caspar had enough imagination for an entire emporium, but they had never seen this. In one box, a troop of medieval knights were waiting to be wound up, ready to joust. In another were horse dragoons and musketeers, in another Roman legionnaires. The boxes of the new long war game came with a set of soldiers ready for battle, but boys could get together with their friends and make armies as big as the imagination allowed. This was how. Emil knew as he let himself be borne up by the excitement around him. There might not have been true magic in the glades. The children here might not have been witnessing the impossible. But this was magic, all the same. Not the showmanship of Caspar and his ostentatious toys, but the simple showmanship of business. The ordinary magic. This was how he might be remembered. Emil was so engrossed that he did not notice at first the women who had entered the glade and looked disapprovingly down on the battle. There were five of them, four matrons and one woman much younger, dressed in grey finery with huge white collars. The younger woman had a most severe look, elegant and cold, with hair that was turning from blonde to a brilliant white, and eyes almost as pale. It was she who set foot in the battlefield. To the consternation of the boys whose soldiers were about to meet, the cries of foul play went up around them, boys scrabbled to right their soldiers, and Emil, who was already referring to the rules of engagement inside each long war box, did not notice that it was to him that the woman was purposefully striding. "Sir," she began. "One moment, madam, this is an emergency." "There is one more emergency at hand, good sir." Emil looked up from his notes and was perplexed to see the woman standing imperiously above, like she was the goddess, and he the lowly soldier sent out to do battle. Pinched between her fingers stood a single white feather. It trembled in the warm emporium air. All of his world zoned in on that single feather. The rest of the emporium faded. When it returned, Emil saw that some of the boys had stopped making battle to stare at him. He came to his senses with a resounding crash. "We are representatives," the woman began, as if reading from a hymn sheet, "of the Order of the White Feather. We are the champions of fairness and courage. We who are forbidden from defending our king and country must do our part nonetheless. And it is with this ambition that I present this feather to you, as a mark of your cowardice, your lack of brotherhood, your childishness, that you are not with our fathers and brothers defending the realm." The feather was in Emil's fingers before he could reply, the woman turning on her heel to join her elders, who had been looking admiringly on. That feather, that white feather. And it hadn't even belonged to a swan. It had been torn from the wing of some scrubbed-out seagull, its quill still marked with the poor bird's blood. He felt the eyes of every boy playing his long war on him. That they should think him a coward was the most injurious of all. Letting the feather slip through his fingers, it floated dreamily over the battlefield. The toy soldiers must have thought it some angel from above. He took off at a run. The women were already marching back along the aisle. They had handed a white feather to one of the Emporium customers as well, a boy barely out of short trousers who had, to his playmate's horror, been gazing up at the dancing ballerina bears when the order descended. They were leafleting, too, handing leaflets out in his Emporium. Emile tore one from the hand of a stunned mother as he cartwheeled past. To the young women of London. Is your best boy wearing khaki? If not, don't you think he should be? If he does not think that you and your country are worth fighting for, do you think he is worthy of you? If your young man neglects his duty to king and country, the time may come when he will neglect you. Join the army today. Emile tore it into a thousand shreds, cast it all around him to join the confetti snow. Then he ploughed after the woman, up into the half-moon hall. I don't have to explain myself to you. This is my emporium, mine, and you're here at my consent or not at all. But since you've flaunted your way in here to make your accusations, I'll have you know this. I was the first to sign up. I was at the recruiting office when summer was still high. I'd be in France now, doing my part for my king and my country, if they would have had me. Coward! Walk into my emporium and call me a coward! I am no coward, madam. My name is Emile Godman, and what's more, I am no one's young man. I am nobody's, do you hear? I am not in danger of neglecting a soul because I don't have a soul I could neglect. Do you understand? The woman had stopped in the doorway, while her elders streamed out into Iron Duke Mews. She turned. Now that she was alone, without those harridans on her shoulder, she did not look as imperious nor as severe. Her pale eyes were even beautiful, Emile thought, and that was such a terrible thing to have noticed. Nobody? She asked, and Emile stood there dumbly, wondering what on earth she could have meant. By special dispensation and in accordance with the benefits of his royal warrant, Papa Jack's emporium opened long into the night. The sounds of games being played, the roar of a winter dragon, all of this carried out into Iron Duke Mews and the quiet cityscape beyond. Joy was infectious, and London deserved its joy, in this of all winters. When the shop floor was finally silent, and Sally Ann leading the shop girls in their nightly parade of the aisles, rooting out any adventurers hoping to hide out overnight, Cathy slipped through the refracting snowflakes and up the servants' stair. As was his habit, Papa Jack had not been there to watch over opening night, though perhaps he watched through his phoenix's eyes, entangled with the spyglass hanging over his workshop hearth. The toy maker remained in his workshop, spiriting new creations into being, and that was where Cathy found him, with his hands deep in the innards of some patchwork beast. A spider, he said as Cathy stepped through. A giant to hide in the cellars and scare boys adventurous enough to venture down. Perhaps a legend to last the winters to come. Cathy strode across the workshop, and before Papa Jack lifted himself from the beast, she cast the bundle of Casper's letters onto the trunk at his side. There they splayed open, Casper's florid hand across each, Mrs. K. Godman, Papa Jack's Emporium, Iron Duke Mews. He's lying to me. He's been lying all along. Robert Kesey is dead. Who knows how many more? She did not tremble, for she had done her trembling now. None of them made it home by first frost. So it isn't as if they're the only ones who lied. The whole world is living a lie, one that nobody cares to acknowledge. It will be fast, they told us. It's barely even a war. Who would dare stand up to our brave British boys? She paused. I'm afraid for him, Jacobs. But if all these letters are lies, if he don't tell the truth, well, then he doesn't care for me at all. Papa Jack stood, the gears in the spider's chest winding down. Hush now, Kathy, he's your Casper. Don't call them lies. Instead, call them fancies. Hasn't Martha slept more easily at night, knowing her papa's safe and sound? Haven't you? Kathy was about to reply when something stalled her. You knew. Sighing, he sank into his chair. The arms rose up to give him comfort. My boy has been writing to me as well. Secrets, thought Kathy with a curse. Her life in the Emporium had been secrets before, but only secrets shared, never secrets between them. You must understand the position he's in. Do you think they would let him write with such news? No, you'd receive letters scoured out, big lines of black. It is an act of love, Kathy, truly it is. What good would knowing? He told you, didn't he? I am his father. I am his wife. He'd have me thinking he's out there, basking in a rose garden, tasting borage and mint, until the day his letters don't come, and instead there's a telegram at the door, some secretary writing for some general, and that's it. The end of Casper's life. The end of my family. Just like it happened for Robert Kesey. She marched back to the door. Kathy, don't you... Papa Jack opened his hands, taking in the letters she had left behind. Keep them, she said. What use are they to me? She was already in the hallway, among hanging jack-in-a-boxes and dismembered clowns, when Papa Jack begged her to stay. Kathy had never liked the sound of Jacob's godman uncertain of himself, and it was this that compelled her to turn around. Back in the workshop, he was lifting something from the trunk where he kept his winter toy. He grasped a little leather journal in his hands, the stub of a pencil dangling from it on a ribbon. I made them for my sons, the year the Emporium opened. Oh, they were secretive little boys, and me barely a father, so long had I been missing from their lives. All they truly had was each other. They had their own language, a feral little tongue I could no more understand than the English around me. This journal, this one you're holding, this was Emile's. The other Casper took with him. I entangled the two together, you see. Go now. Open it up. See for yourself. On the first page were the words, "Does it work?" And below that, in Casper's very particular scrawl, "It really does! Papa is a genius!" The pages after had been torn out, perhaps in some childhood pique. The next were all filled with Casper's hand. And yet the date he had scratched out at the top read, 31st of August, 1914, the very night he had left. How can that be? Papa Jack rolled his fingers, urging her to turn the pages. Here were more of Casper's writing, more and yet more. 2nd of September, 19th, 1st of October, 2nd, 3rd, 4th. Pages and pages were filled with his missives. She saw Robert Kesey's name leap out. Robert Kesey is dead. He writes to you in it, said Kathy. He sends you letters through his journal. One more of the old toys you know about now. One more secret. I built these so that my sons could whisper secrets to each other from one end of the Emporium to the other, or tell stories in the dead of night. Mostly they used it to taunt each other in that long war of theirs. But boys, as the English say, will be boys, They forgot about them in the end. Well, there were so many other new toys in those days. Every season, some new fascination for them to explore. Papa Jack returned to the floor, where he delved again into the belly of the giant beast. Jacobs? Take it, he said. He hasn't hidden a thing from me. I can assure you of that. It's all in there, if you want to see it. All of Caspar Godman's war. The Toymaker's War. Papa Jack's Emporium, November 1914 to August 1917. Sirius was waiting for her when she returned to her bedroom. Perhaps he recognized the journal from Caspar's boyhood days, for he nosed at it with his cross-stitched snout. "Off with you now," said Kathy, first making certain his motors were wound. If she was going to do this, she was going to do it alone. The Emporium at night could be an eerie place, in winter most of all. You could hear the skittering of toys left wound up, and the shop hands, those not making merry hell in the palace, still roamed the aisles, readying for the morning rush. But Kathy locked the door, remained in her own private world, and, when she found the courage, opened the journal. Caspar's handwriting was so like him, elegant and wild, full of bold flourishes and curls. "My papa, I had not known you kept our old journals, but when you pressed this into my hands the morning I left our beloved emporium, I felt a rush of such nostalgia I cannot set it down in words. But perhaps you know it. I treasured this collection of paper and thread once, and I will treasure it now as I head into the unknown, my papa at my side. Promise me that you will keep what news you can from Kathy and Martha. To them I send missives of love. To you, who have seen so much more than me, the truth unvarnished. We have completed our training and embark for Belgium before dawn. Tonight Douglas Flood and I play cards against Robert Kesey and Andrew Dunmore, but I have been forbidden from dealing the pack. They consider me a conjurer. It has been strange to be away from our emporium for more than a night, and for myself I find it stranger still to remember there was a time when the emporium was not home. For the boys I travel with, tomorrow will be their first taste of foreign air. They ask me about the world as if I know anything of it, when the truth is that, to me, those years before the emporium are a dream. Stranger still is being without a meal. We dedicate meals to him. The food is not near Miss Hornung's delectable standard, but a meal would like it all the same. And think of him often. No doubt you find it some comfort that he remains to look over the shop floor and cultivate marvels this summer. And I admit I find it some comfort that he will be there for Kathy and Martha as well. But I remember the look in Emile's eyes when the physicians declared him exempt. Of course, they say we shall be home by Christmas, and, adventuring aside, it is that which I hope for. I should like to see Martha marvelling at opening night, and wake with Kathy to give her our gifts come Christmas morning. There was more. Caspar described his training in details meant to delight his father, lampooning the other recruits and singing the praises of every emporium shophand, who, or so Caspar professed, showed dexterity beyond the requirements of mortal man, and thus had proven themselves particularly adept at fixing a bayonet, patching a sandbag, and shoeing a malcontent horse. Shoeing a stallion is quite different from appending a runner to a rocking horse, but in the end it is not nearly as difficult. Do you remember the Arabians we built for the Christmas of 99? I recall them as more dastardly than any warhorse I am likely to meet. And this reminds me, Papa. Douglas Flood has been assigned as an ostler's assistant. It means he must shovel manure all day, not a duty with which he ever had to contend in the Emporium corrals. The next time Caspar wrote, he was in Belgium, where the 7th Division had arrived too late to prevent the fall of Antwerp, and had turned instead toward the Flemish town of Ypres, already overrun. Kathy knew the town only from the stamps on the bales of linen delivered to the Emporium doors. but the image she had of it proved to be remarkably similar to Casper's own. A tumble-down town of stone walls and turrets, more weathered and steeped in history than any model village or fold-away fortress the Emporium had ever made. It was here, Casper declared, that the division would halt the enemy's advance, and,